beginning of Parshas Chayesara deals with the purchase of Maras HaMachpelah, and the Torah actually devotes quite a number of psukim to the negotiations, to the back and forth. And I would like to pay special attention to this opening section, Bichlal u'Bifrat, and to see through the eyes of the Netziv in the Hamikdavar some of the nuances, some of the dynamics that were in play, and to get a fuller and richer picture through being medactic in the psukim as to how exactly this purchase occurred. And we should begin by asking a very simple question, namely, who exactly was there? Who exactly is Avram talking to at any given time? And what's behind the question is that if we consult various different psukim, we may come up with different answers to this question. That is to say, in Pasuk Gimel, we find Vayakam Avraham Me'al Pnei Meso Vayidaber Al Pnei Ches Leimor. So as we know, the group of people there, it's their territory, and they are Bnei Ches. And similarly in Pasuk Hei, they respond to him Vayanu Bnei Ches Es Avraham Leimor Lo. Okay, so aside from the two individuals called Avram and Ephron, there are a group of people, they are Bnei Ches. In Pasuk Zion, things become somewhat more multi-layered, because we find the words Vayakam Avraham Vayishtachu La'am Ha'aretz Livnei Ches. So what was previously mentioned as Bnei Ches now become the Am Ha'aretz. Now, not to be meant in the pejorative sense, but rather they are the indigenous population. They are the people of the land, the Am Ha'aretz. But they weren't called the Am Ha'aretz originally. They were just called Bnei Ches. And now they're Am Ha'aretz Livnei Ches. Okay. As we move further, we will find in Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayishtachu Avraham Lifnei Am Ha'aretz. So there's been something of a transformation. They began as Bnei Ches, then they're the Am Ha'aretz Livnei Ches, and now they're only the Am Ha'aretz. But then, in Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayishma Avraham al Ephron, Vayishkol Avraham al Ephron, and Sakesev Asher Diber, Ba'aznei Bnei Ches. They're back. So who are they? And why do we keep calling them different things? And that is, of course, a very important question that we need to address. And in fact, the Netziv explains, and this will give us, you know, further insight into what's going on, that actually there are two groups of people. The Am Ha'aretz and the Bnei Ches are not the same. Bnei Ches are the population of that locale. They are the ones with whom you will need to negotiate. Amongst them is Ephron, but in a broader sense, all of them he has to make them happy. But they were not the only ones who were there on that occasion, for a very simple reason. Sarah was a noted personality. At her Levaya, there were many different people who came to pay their respects. It wasn't only Avram and Bnei Ches. They had done a great deal of work in that area and left a great impression, and there were many people who came to pay their respects. And they are the Am Ha'aretz. And what's interesting is, they're there really as bystanders, but they are ultimately part of the picture, as we will see. So if we bear in mind that the Am Ha'aretz and the Bnei Ches are actually two distinct groups of people, we will see how, as things develop, Avram relates to each one of them. Now we begin at the beginning, the first words that Avram says, and he speaks to Bnei Ches, because they're the only ones that he will be negotiating with, and says, Ger v'soshav anochi imachem. Now, as soon as we see the words ger v'toshav, so immediately they strike us as something of a paradox, a contradiction. A ger and a toshav are not the same thing. Ger means temporary, toshav means more permanent. You can't be one, or you can't be both. You're either one or the other. So is he a ger or a toshav? And Rashi deals with this, and Rashi has his famous comment, whichever way you wish to play it, we can be nice, I can purchase as a ger, if you cause trouble, I'm actually the toshav, but they're not the same. But then Netziv explains, al derech ha-pshat, that Avram, in a sense, really is both a ger and a toshav. How so? Because a toshav is someone who lives there long term. Avram does not live, where are we now, where are we talking about? Hebron, Kiryat Arba, Hebron. Avram doesn't live in Hebron, but he used to. That means, as Rashi tells us in Parshas Vayera, for 25 years, he lived in Hebron. I mean, that's got to qualify as a toshav, I think, by any standards. Then, at the age of 100, he moved to Be'er Sheva, where he lived for the next 26, 27 years. So he no longer lives in Hebron. True, but he used to. So now the question is he a permanent resident? No. Is he a complete stranger? Not exactly. He's not a newcomer. He's a familiar face to them. And anyone who's been around will know that if you were there for that slice of 25 years, Avram was a regular part of Hebron. And therefore, says Avram, I'm a ger, true, in the sense that I no longer live here, but I am a toshav, meaning I used to live here, and I lived here for a very long time. And therefore, in deference to that, I'm asking that we should put in motion the negotiations with Ephron in order to procure a makom kavura for Sarah. Now, B'nai Ches answer, and we have to take their first response as we see it, and that's in Pasuk Hei, Vayanu B'nai Ches es Avraham le'mor lo. So they respond and say, Shema'enu Aduni, Nesi Elokim Atobus Ocheinu. Very nice. You're a prince of God amongst us. B'mivchar Kuvarenu Kuvores Meisecha. Amongst the choice of the Kvarim you can choose, Ish Mimenu Es Kivro Lo'yechlem Mimcha Mikvor Meisecha. That's actually a rather magnanimous gesture. Each one, there isn't one of us that wouldn't give up his own grave for you. Okay? At least for the time being. Well, Avram knows that they are not ultimately the people who will decide. In other words, it's Ephron that will decide, but certainly they need to be sounded out. It has to be with the assent of the general populace. And therefore, so far, everything sounds good. He's asked, they've answered, it's a positive answer, and everything's okay all round. And that's why in Pasuk Zion we find, Vayakam Avraham, Vayishtachu la'am ha'aretz livnei ches. Avram gets up, and he bows, and does a lot of bowing. In the beginning of Parshas Chayesara, it's courtesy, it's derech eretz, for number one, for those who are being amenable in the negotiations, and number two, for those who have turned up to pay their respects. I mean, that's the Vayishtachu. And who deserves that courtesy? Currently, everyone, both groups. Am Ha'aretz, firstly, everyone who's arrived. Number two, B'nai Ches, who have responded very positively. But now, we need to get down to business. Because it is Ephron who will decide. And in Pasuk Ches, he asks that they should entreat on his behalf to speak to Ephron, and he will make the decision. Now, at this point, we will see that the B'nai Ches are not as magnanimous as their words would make them out to be. And if we have a look at Pasuk Yud, we should note a couple of things. Firstly, Ve'efron Yoshev Besoch B'nai Ches, Ephron, he dwells amongst the B'nai Ches, Vayan Ephron Achiti Es Avraham, Bo'aznei B'nai Ches, L'chol Ba'esha Ariro, Leimor. So there's a lot happening in this pasuk. Number one, we have an unusual phrase here that Ephron answers Ba'oznei b'nei ches. I mean, that has to be approached very carefully. He answers in the ears of b'nei ches. I mean, what does that mean? Given that people hear with their ears, whenever you speak to them, you speak in their ears. So what is the meaning of the pasuk stressing that he spoke Ba'oznei b'nei ches? We are aware that we have this concept once in a while. Yehuda wants to speak Davar Ba'oznei Adoni. You have this idea of speaking Ba'oznei someone, but it's very rare. And what does it mean? And why is it also that Ephron answers Avram, but it doesn't say that he answered Ba'oznei Avram. It says that he answered Avram Ba'oznei B'nei Ches, and then you have Lachol Ba'isha Ariro, which is everybody else. So everyone's here. He's talking to Avram in the ears of B'nei Ches, and the other people are all there. And how does all of this come together? We should also note that Ephron is referred to as a Chiti the second time he's mentioned in the Pasuk. That's interesting, because normally when he's introduced, that's when he'll get his title. It does not say Vayan Ephron Achiti. It says, or more correctly, it doesn't say, it begins with Ephron Yoshe Basoch B'nei Ches, so first he's Ephron, and then he's introduced again as Ephron Achiti, Es Avraham. So, what's this all about? Says the Netziv, Ephron has a very specific plan for this cave, for this Ma'ar Samach Pela. It's called trying to get as much money from Avram as he possibly can. And what's interesting is he's about to try and squeeze Avram for a fortune, except he's in the public eye. And therefore, it's not so straightforward when everybody's looking to come out and ask Avram for an exorbitant amount of money. So it's going to have to work in a slightly more finessed manner. Avram, at the outset, does not know what he wants. The Am Ha'aretz will remain oblivious throughout, but the B'nei Ches understand each other. When they hear Ephron speaking, the way that he's speaking, they already know what he plans to do. They're all landsmen. And therefore, from the very beginning, Ephron gives an answer. And the Pasuk is telling you, everybody heard it, but it was for the ears of B'nei Ches. When you speak Ba'oznei someone, it means that you have a message that only they will really connect with. That's the point. And therefore, everybody's hearing it, but if you know Ephron and you know what he wants, you know what he's saying. And if you don't, it really sounds like he's saying something else entirely. And now, let us see Ephron at work. See, in Pasuk Yud Beis, pardon me, before we get there, Ephron begins by doing something very low. And in order to understand exactly what he does and how he does it, we need to go back to Pasuk Tes to see where exactly is Ma'ar Samach Pela. And we know it's in Hebron, but specifically look at Pasuk Tes. It says, Avram asks, V'yitein li es Ma'ar Samach Pela shelo. So he asks for Ma'ar Samach Pela. Asher b'ktzei sadehu, which is at the edge of his field. B'kesef male yitneno li. I wish to pay full price. B'sochachem lachuzas kaver. Okay. Interestingly, when Ephron describes it, he says in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Lo Adoni Shema'eni, no, listen to me. Hasodeh nosati lecha. I've given you the field. V'amarar shebo lecha nosatia. And I've given you the cave in it. Le'inei b'nei amin nosatia lach kevor meisecha. So what's happened? It sounds like, on the face of it, Avram wishes to buy Mor HaSemach Pe'ilah, and Ephron offers to give it to him. Okay, they can decide whether he's going to buy it or give it to him. But something else has happened, and it's very, very despicable. Avram describes Mor HaSemach Pe'ilah as being at the edge of the field, as if to say, I'm interested in the cave. I'm not interested in the field. And I don't need to be interested in the field, because the cave is at the side. It's at the edge of the field, right? And therefore, I share, again, b'ktzeh sadehu. So if you sell me the cave, you have the rest of the field for you. So let's just talk about the cave. Mor HaSemach Pe'ilah. I'm not interested in real estate currently. Now, Ephron is not having that. But how can he say to Avram, no, you're going to have to buy the field as well? He can't say that to Avram. But the point is, he's not offering for Avram to buy anything. He's offering to give it to him. So the first thing that Ephron says is, no, I don't wish to accept money for the cave, which is in the middle of my field, which means obviously I'm going to give you the whole field. So point number one is, it's not at the edge, it's in the middle. I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. It really depends on how you look at it. For Ephron, it's smack in the middle of his field, which means the whole field is fafalan. But don't worry, because I'm giving you the whole thing anyway, plus the field. Which, of course, is a message to Avram saying, you're going to have to pay for it and you have to buy the field as well. But we're not there yet, because so far I'm giving you everything. But Ephron knows that Avram will refuse to take a gift. But you can't fault Ephron for offering to give him the whole field, and before you know it, when you pay, you're going to have to pay for everything. Now, Avram catches that. Avram understands what Ephron has done. And also, at this point, Avram, as he sees how everyone there is relating to this, he sees that the B'nai Ches are in on it. In other words, the way that they hear what Ephron is saying, he intuits that the B'nai Ches know exactly what's going on and know that Ephron is trying to take him for a ride. And at that point, says the Netziv, B'nai Ches fall from grace. Avram no longer extends to them the courtesy that he did beforehand. And that is to be found in Pasuk Yud Beis, a glaring omission. Vayishtachu Avraham lifnei am haaretz. He gets up and he bows down again to the am haaretz. Means, thank you very much for coming again, and to B'nai Ches, thank you for nothing. Because he understands at this point, B'nai Ches are in on it with Ephron. So the only ones who will get courtesy at this point are the Ame Ha'aretz, not B'nai Ches. And at Pasuk Yud Gimel, once again he understands that he will need to buy whatever Ephron wishes to sell, namely the cave in the field. And at this point, we come to discuss what they call in modern Hebrew, Tachlis. How much is it going to go for? And in Pasuk Yud Dalet, I mean, the answer is an enormous amount. So much, in fact, that once again, Ephron can still not bring himself to say that he's selling it, because then he's asking for that amount as a price. And I don't know if it's to his credit, but it should be mentioned, Ephron still has a sense of shame for what he's about to say for Avram. It doesn't stop him from doing it, but he can't look him in the eye. And so, even as he's about to tell him, I'm telling you it's worth 400, but I still can't ask you for 400. I'm going to give you it worth 400. That's number one. And number two, Pasuk Yud Dalet, Vayan Ephron es Avram leimor lo. Everything so far has been very public. It's either in front of B'nai Ches, all of it's in front of the Ame Ha'aretz, the Ame Ha'aretz. When the time comes to actually utter the unimaginable sum of 400 shekels, in those days, Ephron cannot even bring himself to say it loud enough for anyone other than Avram to hear. He's no longer talking b'fnei am haaretz, because he will be an object of ridicule and scorn amongst them. It's directly between him and Avram. He doesn't want anyone else to hear. He's embarrassed. And therefore, vayan Ephron es Avram. Now, that's why Avram, as when he hears all of this in Pasuk Tetzayin, Vayishma Avraham es el Ephron, he hears everything that Ephron is saying. Vayishkol Avram le Ephron es hakesef asher diber ba'aznei b'nei ches. The word diber here is a past perfect. In other words, Avram understands there's no way that he can pay less than 400 because it's clear to them that Ephron has already told Bnei Ches that he's going to ask Avram for 400. Asher diber ba'aznei Bnei Ches. That was their understanding. And if Avram wishes to avoid any contention and grumbling post facto about the sale, he's going to have to pay the amount that was actually said. And these are the comments of the Netziv with regards to how Avram navigates in his time of grief, really, the petty, selfish concerns of Ephron and Bnei Ches, and that's how they go down in the Torah. The money that he gives him is mentioned in Pasuk Tetzayin. Arba meo shekel kesef over la socher. Over la socher, which has now since become a catchphrase. Rashi explains, over la socher means that anyone would accept it. Any socher. In other words, the best quality coins. Not the coins that shrink in the wash or break when you take them out of your pocket. The real thing. Over la socher. Top quality. Rebbe Ephraim Zalman Margolius, who was famous as the author of the Mate Ephraim and Beis Ephraim, one of the great poskim of the 1800s, has a very interesting, it's quite similar to the Netziv, Over la socher. Rashi understands Over la socher means Avram gave him the money, gave Ephron the money. It's money that Ephron could use with any socher. But interestingly, a socher is a businessman and often someone who brokers deals. And Rebbe Margolius understood that what the pasuk is saying is that the payment from Avram to Ephron took place through a socher. It took place through a broker. And the reason why is because acharei hadvar me'ele, the more we appreciate how preposterous it was to ask for that amount of money, the more we'll understand that when it actually came the time to collect, Ephron could not bring himself to come face to face with Avram, hold out his hand, and take that amount of money. So he sent his agent and work it out between you. That much shame he had, the amount of money. Could be the socher, I had no idea what's going on. I've been sent to collect 400 shekels. For what? No one told me. Over la socher. It went through the socher. He couldn't bring himself to face Avram with the money. But to come back to Rashi, over la socher means the best quality coin, the best mintage. And should we ask the question, what were the best coins? Is there a way to find out? So there's a very interesting Gemara in Maseches Baba Kama, that Tzadik Zayin Amud Beis, which tells us that Avram actually minted his own coins. Why? As we know, in those times, whenever there was an event to be celebrated, to be publicized, it was done through the minting of coins. I mean, they'll tell the story and they're there to stay. And actually, says the Gemara, Avram minted coins when Yitzchak was born in order to publicize the miracle of the birth of Yitzchak. And the Gemara says that on the one side of the coin, it said, Zokein en Zakeno. An old, elderly man, an elderly woman, well beyond childbearing age, and nonetheless, here, they had a child called Yitzchak. Now, Lekemida de la Remiza Ba'araisa, there is nothing which is not alluded to in the Torah. Over la socher, what's interesting about the word socher is that it's written choser, that is to say. Socher really is samach vav chet resh. It's written samach chet resh. It's read as if it has a vav, but it's written without the vav. Okay, that itself is not particularly unusual, except over la socher. What is the meaning of the word over? Well, the simple translation is that it passes. Passes through any socher, to any agent. But there is another translation of the word over, and that means that it proceeds from the word avar, what is already passed. As we say, we make brachas on all mitzvahs, over la'asiyosan, prior to performing the mitzvah. Therefore, over la socher means prior to socher. What is the meaning of prior? What comes before socher? There was one of the Mefarshim, his name is Rav Shimon Melior. I don't know anything about him. I've seen this quoted, but I know this about him. It's what he's about to say. The word socher is three letters, samach, chet, and resh. in order to find out what is over la socher, you need to find out what comes before samach, chet, and resh. What comes before samach in the aleph base is nun. What comes before chet is zayin. And what comes before resh is kuf. And the three letters of nun, zayin, and kuf are the letters of the word zaken. Now there's only three letters in the word because it's written chaser. But it's read as if it was written socher with a vav. And if we add a vav to the word, and then we find out what is over to the vav, so in addition to the zayin, kuf, and nun, we have hey. And therefore, in over la socher, the way it's written and the way it's read, you have zaken and zakena, and they are the coins that are over la socher. Those are the coins that Avram minted. So, once again, the Torah transmits on many frequencies, and that's a nugget from the world of Remez. If we come to the center now of the Parsha, so we have the test of Eliezer with Rivka, and overwhelmingly, it is about the Midah of Chesed, that she has to, in response to his request, Agmi'inina, Batmai Mikadeh, he asks for water, and she will respond not only for him, also for his camels, truly above and beyond the call of duty, and even beyond that. And it's interesting to note that of all of the midos that Eliezer is looking for, Chesed is paramount amongst them. And if we ask the simple question, well, why would it be? If there's many positive character traits, I mean, why is he looking for Chesed more than anything else? So the simple answer may well be because to be a good wife and mother, that's the most important midah that she needs, to be a giving person, a caring person. The Chasam Sofer has a further element to draw out from here. As we know, Avram and Yitzchak are quite different from each other in the way they go about things and in terms of their primary characteristic. Avram is chesed, chesed la Avram. He's all about acts of kindness. Yitzchak, on the other hand, almost what seems to be the polar opposite, the other end of the spectrum. Yitzchak is din, gevuras Yitzchak, pachad Yitzchak. And that's how each one, in a sense, develops and instills these midos into the makeup of the Jewish people. That's in terms of the avos, Avram and Yitzchak. What we perhaps emphasize less are the imahos. But the Chasam Sofer says, it's interesting that, you know, we say that motza min es mino, but from a certain point of view, the spouse needs to have other midos because ultimately they will need to complement each other and balance each other out. Sometimes, if they're both extreme in one direction, then the house could be lacking a certain balance and stability. And therefore, sometimes the greatest benefit that can come from the wife to the husband and vice versa is the extent to which she's different from him, and therefore makes up and supplements for the areas in which he is significantly one way, she's significantly the other way. And together, they balance the house. And in fact, the Chasam Sofer says, in his opinion, this is the meaning, or one of the meanings, of the concept of Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo, which means a helpmate for him, Kenegdo means against him. And what that means is, sometimes, the way that she will help him is by being Kenegdo. If he is significantly one way, she will have to be the other way, and together they'll harmonize the house. Sarah, it is possible to say, was Keneged Avram. She was Keneged Avram in the sense that, of course, she was a part of the whole mifal of Chesed and Lushivasi Ugos, and Avram is Megaris Hanoshim and Sarah Megaris Hanoshim, but from a certain point of view, she was much more Midas Hadin than Avram. And this we see when there are certain tough decisions to be made, it's Sarah that makes them, and not Avram. Where Avram is inclined to have more compassion for Yishmael, he doesn't want to send him away, and Sarah says he has to go. And in a sense, that's Ezer Kenegdo. She helped him by being Kenegdo. Because if he would have stayed, then Yitzhak would have been compromised. With Yitzhak himself, it is the other way. In other words, as surely as Avram, who was Chesed, needed Sarah, who had a certain aspect of Midas Hadin, in order to make sure that everything that had to happen, happened. By the same token, Yitzhak, who is now Midas Hadin, he will need someone who is Chesed in order to balance him out. And that's why, says the Chasam Sofer, Eliezer for Yitzhak is looking more than anything else for Midas HaChesed. As he says in Pasuk Yudalud, Osa hochachta la'avdecha le'Yitzchak. She is the perfect one for Yitzchak. Sometimes if they're both completely in one way, so then there is a certain lack of balance. Brings to mind, it's not exactly this Nekuda specifically, but I always think, when I think to this Chasam Sofer, my father Zatzal told me about Rav Herzog, whose Rebbetzin at a certain point demanded that his salary be paid to her and not to him. And the reason why is because as he used to walk home from Shul, having received his paycheck, or his salary, he gave it away. He gave all his money away. People that were needy, and people asked him, and he gave. And he actually returned home with no money. And it's really an amazing thing. Because Rav Herzog, if one's familiar with his writings, I mean, he was a gong, intellectually. But his heart was made of butter. Mm. And he couldn't hold on to a penny if someone else needed it. And he ended up with nothing. So the Rebbetzin says that he cannot be entrusted with his salary. So you have to give it to me. Ezer Kenegdo. So these are the comments of the Chasam Sofer. That's why for a husband, for Yitzchak, has to excel in the midah of Chesed. Now, I want to take a look for a moment at actually a grammatical point, but we'll see a certain yisod will come out. Where is it to be found? In Pasuk Yudches. Perek Kafdalet Pasuk Yudches. Perek Kafdalet, actually Pasuk Yudches. So we'll come back to exactly the nusach of the test. But just to note, Vatachal Hashkoso, so she finishes to give Eliezer to drink. Vatomer Gam Ligmalecha Eshov. Ad imkilu lishtos. She says, I'll also draw for your camels until they've drunk their fill. Okay. Is there anything out of place, unusual, noteworthy about this pasuk? Actually, there is. If we look at the word eshov, we will see that the aleph, the second aleph, has a komatz, eshov. Now, should we ask the question, well, is it not true that the future would be Eshav, right? Lishav is Eshav. So, of course, if we know a thing or two, we will know that actually there exists a concept which is called Tam Masik, the pausal form, whereby when something comes at the end of a sentence or of a phrase within a sentence, so it will change the nikud of the word, and specifically to a komatz. And there, thus you find, for example, in the beginning of Lech Lecha, which really highlights the point, Vayetzu laleches arza kena'an, vayavo arza kena'an. As kena'an became kena'an, the patach became a komatz, as we reach the end of the pasuk, and indeed the end of a phrase. That's called tam mafsik. Indeed, this relates to our tefillahs the whole time. There's something of a discussion, actually, that always accompanies the beginning of Mashiach HaRuach, is it Morid HaGeshem, Morid HaGoshem? That really depends on whether we see it as the end of a significant phrase or maybe just the beginning of the bracha. That's why some say Geshem, some say Goshem. It's one of my favorite halachic questions to say Geshem or Goshem, because Rav Moshe Feinstein says Goshem and Rav Shlomo Zalman says Geshem. So if only all questions were like that, you couldn't possibly do anything wrong. You're either like Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. These are, if only, halavai, we only had these questions. But now, if that's true, then eshav, the on top of the word, there's two dots on top of the word eshav is a zakif, and a zakif is a pause, and a pause turns eshav to eshav. And it's nice and simple. Except, of course, it's not so simple. And the reason why, if there's one thing we should know about how tam mafsik works, that the end of a phrase, the pause can change the nikud, we should know this. It is specifically the strongest pause in the middle of a pasuk that will change the nikud. There's a hierarchy. And all of the weaker pauses don't make a difference. You always look at the stronger pause. The strongest pause in the middle of a pasuk that can exist is an esnafta. The esnafta, which is actually to be found under the words lahashko so, under the taf of lahashko so, that's an esnafta, and that is the strong pause. An esnafta will change the tamasik. And whenever there's an esnafta, so a zakif no longer imposes itself. A zakif is the second strongest. And you should know there is a third. And we almost never see it express itself. And that's the tipcha. The tipcha is actually, it looks like a comma, lahavdil, and really acts like a comma. For those who are medakdik, there's always something of a pause after a tipcha. And once in a while, we find that even the tipcha makes itself heard. And it's the strongest pause in the pasuk, and it changes the nikud in the pasuk. Case in point, Bamidbar, Perek, Tes, Pasuk, Beis, Korban Pesach, V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moado. When do we ever call it posach? It's Pesach. Except there's no esnachta there, there's no zokif there. For once, the tipcha is actually the strongest mafsik under the word Pesach and change it to posach. In Parshas Shelach, lematei Reuven, lematei Yehuda, lematei all of the matos, lematei Ephraim with the comot Hoshea ben Nun. It's such a short posuk, the tipcha under Ephraim changed it to Ephraim. And so it goes. For our purposes, that means that we have a problem. Because if we always will lay emphasis on the strongest pause, so how is it that the weaker pause changed the nikud? If there's an esnachto here, we should have paid no attention to the zokif, and the word should have remained eshav. Now this is a question, as you can appreciate, that doesn't bother the average shulgoer, but it bothered Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And he gives a very interesting response, and it actually resonates with a comment of the Magen Avraham, as we shall see. Rabbi Yaakov says, we have a principle. Kol pasuk de lo paske Moshe, anan lo paskina. What that means is that when it comes to quoting psukim, where possible, we do not quote psukim in halves. We'll quote the whole thing. Now, of course, there's many qualifications and many exceptions. And one of them is the fact that the Yud Gimel Midrash HaRachamim, Hashem Hashem Karachem V'chanun, which we often say just those words, like when we take the Sefer Torah out on Shalosh Regalim, we just begin Hashem Hashem Karachem V'chanun. Now, that's actually taken from a pasuk, and it's not the beginning of a pasuk. We start the pasuk in the middle. Because, of course, as we know from Slichos, the Pasuk begins, Vayavor Hashem apanav vayikra. That's how the Pasuk begins. And therefore, when we say, Hashem Hashem karachem v'chanun, we're beginning in the middle of a Pasuk, and we're not meant to do that. So how is it acceptable? Says the Magen Avraham. The reason why we are able to begin with the words, Hashem Hashem karachem v'chanun, is because from a certain point of view, they are the beginning of a pasuk. How so? Because they're beginning of the sentence that the pasuk quotes. As if to say, the pasuk begins, Vayavor Hashem al panav vayikra. It's true. When the pasuk is talking to us, what does the pasuk say? Where does the pasuk begin to speak? With the words, Vayavor Hashem al panav vayikra. But that says that Hashem called out, colon, open quotation marks, and what did he say? And the first words that he said were, Hashem, Hashem, karachem v'chanun. Whether it's Hashem calling or Moshe calling, it actually depends on the tipcha there. But, says the Magen Avraham, that is why we are not considered to be beginning a posuk in the middle. Because Hashem, Hashem, karachem v'chanun are actually a posuk within a posuk. Because they're the sentence quoted within the posuk. Adkan, from the world of halacha. But now let it see how it dovetails into the world of Dikduk. Because, says Rabbi Yaakov, let's go back to our pasuk. Vatechal hashgoso. So she finished giving Eliezer to drink. Vatome gam ligmalecha eshav adim kirulushtos. We had a problem. Eshav became eshav. Why? Because it's a pause. Our problem was, the two dots on top of eshav are a zokif. They're not the strongest pause in the pasuk. The strongest pause is the esnachta in the beginning. Vatechal lahashgoso. So in the presence of its betters, called the Esnachta, the Zokif should not have imposed itself. Says Rabbi Yaakov, that based on what we have seen, sometimes we will look upon someone speaking in a Pasuk as a Pasuk in itself. And therefore, the Pasuk says, Vatechalash Goso, and then says what she said, Vatomer. And what did she say? She said, Gam likmalecha eshav adim kilulishtos. If we look at what she said as a self-contained pasuk, then the strongest pause within that pasuk is actually the zokif on the word eshav, which turns it into eshav. So this is an altogether different way of looking at the psukim. Every dot and every patach and komats. In England, we're used to the concept of mining P's and Q's. And when it comes to Torah, that means patachs and komats. Everyone has to be in place. If there's a change, it needs to be explained. And Ashreinu, we have Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and those like him who are there to explain these things to us. Now, I'd like to go back and just contrast the in Pasuk Yudalad of Perik Kafdalad, the answer that Eliezer hopes to hear from whoever it is that will respond correctly, and what it is that Rivka actually says. In Pasuk Yud Dalet, he says, V'haya hana'areh, asher omar eleha, hatinocha deicha eshte. So if I will say to her, please, could you give me to drink? V'omra, and she will say, shesei, v'gam gmalecha ashke, and I will give your camels to drink. She's the one. She will offer not only to give me, but also the camels. She's the one. Osahu chachto le'abdecha liyitzah. Okay, so that's the formula for success. If she'll respond that way, she's the one. She will say, I will give to you and also to your parents. Now, as it happened, when he asked her in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayara to Eved Lekrosa, he ran towards her, and of course that makes the test harder, because he hardly looks like he's dying of thirst. But he ran up to her. So he seems to be, you know, in peak fitness, and asked her to give him a drink. Vayomer Hagmini Nom Admai Mikadech. And she said, Vatomer Shesei Adoni. She says, please, drink. Vatimaher, Vatorit Kado Yada Vatashkehu. And she gives him to drink. Then, Pasuk Yudes, Vatechal Lahashgoso. And when he had finished drinking, then, Vatomer Gamlik Malecha Eshav, which is the Pasuk that we saw, Adam Kilulishtas. So what's interesting is, to put it in one sentence, what Eliezer forecasted, or as he was predicting or hoping, what is it she'll say? She will say, I'll give you to drink and your camels to drink. Meaning, she will respond to all of that at once. As it happened, she didn't do that. The first thing she said was to give him to drink, and that's that. She divided it into two. She didn't talk about the camels until after he'd finished drinking, and then she said, she'll give the camels. And the question is, what is behind that? So there are two responses to this, and each one, the more we appreciate exactly the enormity of what Eliezer was asking of her and her gesture in response, so the more we'll appreciate that her attention to detail and delicacy on top of that is just overwhelming. Says the Arachaim HaKadosh, she deliberately did not tell him at the time when she offered him to drink that she was going to give the camels to drink. And the reason why is because if she's already told him that she's going to give the camels to drink, that means that she is pressuring him to finish drinking quickly, because she's already told him that she has a great deal of more work to do for him. And therefore, when he would feel that he's on the clock, if she would say, I'll give you to drink and then your camel, so that means that he's conscious, and it's already been stated, as long as he is drinking, she's waiting, and she has much more to do, and he's holding her up. And therefore, Rivka, although she has already decided that she will offer to to give his camels to drink. She doesn't say anything about it as long as he's drinking, as if to say, from his point of view, she's just giving him, and therefore there's nothing else that she's offered to do for him. He has all the time that he needs. And that's the time that he takes. And he's not pressured at all. And when he's finished, and then it's over. And then Rivka says, and now I'll give to your camels to drink. I mean, that's a level of sensitivity. And once again, considering the fact that she should have said no to him in the first place, to be thinking about things in that way. And the Alshech HaKadosh says something else. And these small things, quote unquote, are big things when we consider exactly the situation that she was in. Says the Alshech, there's many different ways to perform kindness for someone. And there's many different ways to refer to them and to describe what you're doing. Rivka did not say in one sentence, I will give you to drink and then I'll give your camels to drink. Because she did not wish to put Eliezer in the same sentence as his animals. As if to say, I'm taking stock of my workload here, and there's you and 10 camels. 1 plus 10 equals 11. So first I'll deal with you, and then I'll do your camel. It's all the same thing. It's the same water. And therefore, she accords Eliezer the dignity of not putting him in the same sentence, as if to say, my job for today is 10 camels plus you. But rather, she gives him his own gesture, as if to say, in the fullness of time, she will give the camels to drink. But he's not just another camel. He's not recipient number 11 in the watering business. He is the entire enterprise. And then his camels take on another slice of that event. And once again, such poise and such form, in addition to the enormity of the gesture of undertaking to do it, to give consideration as to how to say it. What way will be most sensitive to Eliezer to give him covered, in addition to all of that, that is outstanding. That's Osa Chachta, and that's even beyond Eliezer's expectations. So these are some of the Ha'aras from these details of the Psukim. Mm-hmm. From the Psukim. Now Eliezer brings Rivka back home, and if we have a look in Pasuk Samach Zayin, Perek Hatzal, it's a long perek. Yofas Tichosin Shel Avdei Ovos, the Torah tells it to us, and then Eliezer repeats it, and it's all there. And in Pasuk Samach Zayin, towards the end, this is the final pasuk. Vayviyeha Yitzchak Ha'ole Sora Ima. So Yitzhak takes her into Sarah's tent, Vayikaches Rivka, Vatilo Leisha, Vayaveha, and then he married her, and then he loved her, Vayinachem Yitzhak Acharei Ima. Now, the beginning of the Pasuk, it seems quite straightforward. He brought her into Sarah's tent, and then he married her. And along comes Rashi, and the Pasuk will never be the same again. Ha'o'ela Sarah Imo. He brought her into Sarah's tent, says Rashi, meaning Vayaviyeha Ha'o'ela. He brought her into the tent. Vaharihi Sarah Imo. And she was like his mother. She was a tzadekas like Sarah. What does that mean? How did that happen? Kilomar V'naaseis Dugmas Sarah. She was on a par with Sarah Imo. She calls man she Sarah Kayemes, because as long as Sarah was there, it's a very well-known Rashi, it's from Medrash. As long as Sarah was alive, Hayaner Doluk me Erev Shabbos le Erev Shabbos, the light stayed lit from Erev Shabbos. Ubracha Mitzuya Beisa, and there was abundant blessing in the dough. The Anan Kashur Al HaOhel, and there was the tent really of the Shekhinah over the Ohel, which when you think about it, represent the three key items of Avodah, of the Beis HaMikdash. You have the Ner Dolok, which is the menorah, like the Ner Tamid. You have Bracha Metzuyah Be'isa, like the Lechem Aponim, and the Anan Kashur, which is like the Anan of the Ketores. So that was the ultimate Jewish home attaining the status of a Mishkan. Umishem Esa, Pasku. And when Sarah died, they went away. Ukshefas Rivka Chazu, and Rivka came back When Rivka came, they came back. So this is Rashi's comment on the pasuk. And of course, Rashi has done an amazing thing. Because it turns out that this phrase, ha'oela sara imo, are two separate things. The pasuk is not to be read in a run, in a flow, as if to say, he brought it to the tent of sorrow, which is the Pashtus, let us call it. The simple understanding. But rather, it says, Vayivyeh Yitzchak ha'oela, and Sara Imo isn't qualifying the tent, it's qualifying her. He took her to the tent, and she was Sara Imo. Not the tent belonged to Sara. So Rashi has prized apart two things that seem to be part of a flow. Not only Rashi, we should note, Unkelus has already done that. In his Targum, in his translation, Unkelus says, Va'alas Yitzchak lemashkana, Yitzchak brought her into the tent. V'chazav ha'taknin ovdaha ka'ovdei Sara imo. He saw that her deeds were as worthy of as those of Sara, his mother. So Unkelus has done exactly the same thing. That the tent is one thing, and Sara imo is about Rivka. It's not about the tent. It's not telling you whose tent it was. It's telling what type of person Rivka was. So Unkelus has already done that. Slightly different than Rashi. Rashi sources in the Medrash that he saw that she was like Sara in the sense that all those miracles came back. For Unkelus, it wasn't about miracles, it was about her Masim Tovim. Naturally, the two go together, but the Brisker Rav was wont to comment with regards to this translation of Unkelus that even miracles are not a substitute for Masim Tovim. That's really what Unkelus is saying. It's very nice. And of course, Bedera Klal, they go together. But if all you have is the miracles and not the Masim Tovim, you should still beware. But as soon as he saw the Taknin of Daha, so then she's Sara Ima. But of course, the question on all of this is, Ma Ra'u Al Kocha? How could it be? How can we take that? And of course, the Medrash can say many things, because it's the job of the Medrash to explain things out there, Hadrash. But Rashi will only ever respond to pshat issues in the pasuk, and he will only ever quote the Medrash when it relates to resolving a pshat matter. And Unkelus is translating, and he also divides the two. So the Mefarshim say, beginning with the Mizrahi and beyond, that the point is very simple. What we call the simple translation of the pasuk, the simple meaning of the pasuk, is a Loshan Saginor. It's a euphemism for not really understanding the syntax of the pasuk at all. It's an expression of lack of awareness as to how Loshan HaKodesh works, for a very simple reason. The pasuk says, Vayivyeh HaYitzchak HaOhela Sara Imo. The word HaOhela begins with a hey. That's the hey HaYediyah, the definite object, the definite article. Never in the Chumash do we find a word which is qualified both by Hei HaYediyah at the beginning and then by the construct as to telling you more about it. You either know what it is or you don't. If it says Ha'ola, it means nothing else needs to be said. If there's a Hei HaYediyah, you know what it is. If you need to be told, then you don't know. You never have together both Ha'ola, Ha, and then still describing to you exactly what it is, because that means you didn't know. So there should be no Hei at the beginning. And therefore, says the Mizrahi, Vayivyeh Yitzchak, Ha'oela means anything you need to know about the tent, you know already. Any further words are no longer describing the tent. They're describing her. She is Sarah, Sarah Ima. And moreover, there's a further nuance here. And that is that, and this is pointed out by the Maskil of David, it's an interesting pasuk. Because Rivka is referred to a number of times, but she's only called by name about halfway through the pasuk. And as the pasuk begins with a pronoun, it says, "Vayivyeh HaYitzchak HaOhela Sara Imo." Now, of course, we know who it was. It's Rivka, but the pasuk doesn't say, and it hasn't spoken about her. She's not the most recently mentioned proper noun. So it begins with a pronoun, and then halfway through the pasuk, it says, "Vayikach Es Rivka." So if he took Rivka, then who did he bring into the tent? Obviously Rivka. So why, the pasuk never will invoke the use of the noun itself after having already gotten involved in the pronouns. It should have been the other way around. It should have said Vayaveyes Rivka Ha'oela and then Vayikachecha. So why does it say Vayivieha and then Vayikaches Rivka? It doesn't mention her by name. That's a good shaila. Says the Maskil David, because that further underscores the point of Rashi, as is sourced in the Medrash, that the beginning of the Pasuk is about finding out the quality of Rivka. Is she on a par with his mother, with Sarah Imo? She's tzedekah, like Sarah Imo. And therefore, she doesn't get called by name Rivka until it's already been established that she's like Sarah. She's no one until she's like Sarah. And then she's called by name, Vayikaches Rivka. And these are very delicate points within the flow of the Pasuk. And what is the message of all of this? I think that perhaps part of it relates to what we spoke about in terms of Avram and Yitzhak. That is to say, they have very different ways of going about things. Avram is Midas HaChesed, Yitzhak is Midas HaDin, and in terms of Ezer Kinegdo, it's the opposite. Sarah is more Midas HaDin, Rivka is Midas HaChesed. And whenever one encounters a different path, so it's always important to ascertain whether it's a different path because it has a different goal, or a different path that's ultimately headed towards the same goal. Avram and Yitzchak take different paths, but they're all headed towards the same goal. That's why Yitzchak is, in next week's parsha, it's underscored. Yitzchak has been Avram, Avram holding it's Yitzchak. That cohesion, that unity between the two is because they're two different paths towards the same goal. Yitzchak is familiar with the path of Sarah, his mother, and that brought a certain bracha. And because it was all orientated towards the highest goals, it brought bracha in every area. It brought bracha ba'isa, which has been Adam l'chaveiro, anan kashur lahar, that's been Adam l'makom, the light, right, which is the light of understanding. She had these three brachas because through her midah, it was used in the cause of the ultimate good, and therefore this bracha accrued to her tent. When Rivka comes in with a different midah, it's no longer midas hadin in that way, but rather much more midas hachesed. So the question is, okay, it's a different path. Is it heading in a different direction? Or is it nonetheless another strain that will bring out the full realization and expression of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants them to live in this world? And lo and behold, all the brachas that existed with Sarah that were brought about through her avoda in her way, they all came back through Rivka, even though she had a different way. But it was a different aspect, but still very much part of the same picture. And if that's the case, then Yitzchak was able to fully accept her as the Ezer Kenegdo because their goals were fully in tune. So these are some of the ha'aras from the beginning of the parsha and the end, each one in their own specific way of communicating their messages. And we'll leave it over there for this evening.